We're going to have such a good time this morning, aren't we? First of all, this is a really special church. I love our church. We do so much stuff is done as a result of God doing something new in us. He makes us new people and he does new things through us. And I'm so proud of you. Every person here who went and got one of those name tags from the tree to bless somebody this year, if you've participated in the last year in giving, because we've given to so many different objectives and different people and different ways of participating in all that God is doing in our world, and it makes Christmas time more special because we did all these little things along the way that then produce these big things at the end of the year. And so I'm just really excited for every person who's just said, Jesus, I want to be different. I want to be new. And I give you permission to change my heart. So this series is called Great Expectations. And we're just talking about the fact that when you're a kid, you got to be excited about Christmas. You're so excited about Christmas when you're a kid. And we all know why, right? Because of presents. You're not even thinking about Jesus. Like, Jesus is this thing that happens later. It happens after you open the Nintendo. That's when Jesus happens. Because I remember telling my mom, like, there's like only 12 more weeks till Christmas. And she was like, yeah, that means that both like Halloween and Thanksgiving are gonna happen before Christmas happens. I didn't even care. Because I had done all the things that you need to do to alert Santa / your grandparents what you wanted for Christmas. Which, like, we have Amazon now, and you can make, like, wish lists. But when I was a kid, there was, like, an analog Amazon called the JCPenney catalog. And you would open it up, and there would be pictures of all the things that you could get, and then you would circle it. And then you would break the spine of the catalog so that whenever someone tried to open it, it would automatically open to the page that you had circled exactly what it is you wanted. Because, I mean, you want good gifts at Christmas, don't you? I mean, you really want a good gift. But people aren't always giving good gifts, are they? You ever get something that you think to yourself, who is this person and why did they give this to me? Like, what is it about you that made you think about me when you got this terrible thing for me? And you have to say the same thing when you open a bad gift, right? It's the same thing every time. You can't even say their name. You're so disappointed. You shouldn't have. Because you're being honest, but they don't know that. There's just certain things you shouldn't give as a gift, right? Like, you should not give anyone cosmetics for Christmas. Even if they like cosmetics, don't buy them cosmetics. They can get cosmetics themselves. Because you may be thinking, oh, I love you, but what they're receiving is you don't look good enough. Same thing with exercise equipment. Yeah, exercise equipment. On TV, the person getting that exercise bike is so excited to get a bicycle that goes no place. But in real life, when you give that to somebody, they're like, this isn't enough for you? Like what I'm working with right now? Don't give anybody any sort of cleaning supplies. That's a hint. Socks, you can give those any day of the year. It's not anything you need to worry about, people having socks. If it's a light, you can put it in a stocking stuffer, but don't, like, as a present, here are socks. We have plenty of socks in America. People can pick them up for themselves on the way to the gym. You can get socks at, like, Walgreens. They're not hard to find. You can tell a robot to get you socks. Alexa, get me socks. And socks will show up at your door 2 days later. It's not a surprise. It's not exciting to get socks. Books, don't give anybody books. You can, like, if you want somebody to read something and get smarter, give that to them on any other day of the year. You don't need to give that. You give somebody a book on Christmas, it needs to be, like, collectible or a first edition. Other than that, you've just given them homework. And you know what? School's out. You don't need more homework. You're trying to take a break from school at that point. Lastly, if it says, as seen on TV or not available in stores, there's a reason for that. It's because it's not very good. It's not going to work for very long, and it's soon to be in an aisle at Goodwill. So, as seen on TV. Now, if there's anything worse than getting a bad gift, it's giving a bad gift. And you know how you know you've given a bad gift? Someone opens it, and you know what they say? You shouldn't have. And you know in your heart, I shouldn't have. I really shouldn't have. I once gave my wife jewelry that I bought at Sears. Now, some of you are thinking to yourself, that seems a little mean to make fun of the good folks at Sears. All I'm saying is that the problem wasn't Sears, the problem was me. Because if you can purchase jewelry in the exact same store that you can purchase Craftsman tools, that's gonna be some very sturdy jewelry. It's not going to be as delicate as the person receiving the jewelry would like for it to be. It also, I thought she looked good in purple, so I got a purple stone, to which she looked at it and said, "My birthstone isn't purple." Also, that's the day I discovered birthstones. Here's the good news. You can come back from this because we went on to get married and we're having a wonderful life, despite my lack of gift-giving prowess. I wasn't aware that a gift says something about the giver and it says something to the receiver. It says something very specific to the receiver. What that gift said was, "I spent too much money and I don't know you well enough or much about the world in general." And I think that at this Christmas season, if we're gonna live out of those great expectations that God puts in our hearts, we can learn something very specific from the scripture about God, God's gift giving, and the first gifts given at Christmas. You know that people give gifts at Christmas because Jesus is God's gift to you and I. Like the very first Christmas, God went out and got everybody the exact same thing. It just turned out to be the same thing we all needed, Jesus. That God looked at us and he said, "I know you, I see what you need, and I'm gonna provide for you so that you can become all I created you to be." And that's exactly what the Magi did when they came to visit Jesus in the book of Matthew chapter 2. If you have your Bibles, open with me the book of Matthew chapter 2. We're gonna look at a very misunderstood part of the Christmas story, and I'd suggest to you that if we examine the details, we're gonna come to discover what giving should be at Christmas. And we're gonna understand the story of Jesus probably in more detail than we possibly could have imagined before we came in today. Sound good? Okay, in Matthew chapter 2, here's what you need to know. This guy Matthew, one of Jesus' close friends, he writes a biography about Jesus' life, and when he's describing the first Christmas, when he's describing Christmas, he leaves out all the good stuff. Everything you've seen in Charlie Brown Christmas, that comes from Luke's story in Luke chapter 2 with the angels and the choir and all that stuff. The shepherds, not in Matthew's story. Matthew tells a story that takes place a little bit later. Now, here's the thing. As we read through this, I want you to put yourself in the mindset of people who lived 2,000 years ago. Because we don't live 2,000 years ago, things about 2,000 years ago can be a little bit hard for us to comprehend. But you'll see that as much as things are different today, people still very much the same back then. Sound good? Okay, so it says this in Matthew chapter 2, starting in verse 1, that Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea. Jesus was born where? Bethlehem. And that's in the county of Judea, which is where all the children of Judah lived, right? So Judah was one of Israel's sons, and all the people in Judea, Jesus is born in that area in Judea, in the city of Bethlehem. So Jesus is born in Bethlehem of Judea during the reign of King Herod. That name is gonna come back into play later. Here's what you need to know about Herod. He's a bad person. Like, you would not want him at your Christmas. You wouldn't invite him back if he accidentally showed up. He's the king of Israel. Now, about that time, some wise men from eastern lands arrived in Jerusalem asking, "Where is the newborn king of the Jews? We saw his star as it rose, and we have come to worship him." Now, this is amazing because Matthew tells us straight away, where has Jesus been born? Good, you guys are with me. Bethlehem of Judea. But they arrive where? In Jerusalem. So why do they go to Jerusalem looking for this new baby who's been born? For the exact reason that if you were looking for my grandparents, you might go to Palm Springs or Del Boca Vista in Florida. Because that's where people like that hang out. If you are going to be born a Jewish person who's going to be king someday, we would call that a prince. If you're going to be a prince of the Jewish people, you're probably going to be born in the capital city of Jerusalem. So when these wise men from eastern lands come looking for the new baby, they show up at the palace to talk to King Herod because they're assuming whose baby was just born. Herod's baby has just been born. Spoiler alert, Herod did not have a baby. Here's what you need to know about Herod. Herod is not supposed to be the king of the Jews. He's not even really Jewish himself. This part may be hard for you to follow or understand because politics are a little different then than they are today. About half the people in Israel do not want the person who's in charge to be in charge. They didn't vote for him. They don't like him. The people who were in charge put him in charge to keep the peace. The people who don't want him to be the king are convinced that if they can prove he was actually born someplace else, he doesn't get to be king anymore. Now, he actually was, his dad is Jewish and his mom is from a country called Edom. So they don't want him there. And they think if they can get rid of him, things will be better. But he is paranoid and does not want to lose being the king. So when the wise men show up and they're like, hey, we heard that the new king has been born. He is now not happy about it because this is a direct threat to his rule. Now, you have to ask yourself, how did the wise men know to come because they saw a star in the sky? That doesn't make any sense to us. Like, never have you just been outside and you look up and you're like, what a beautiful star. I bet the Kardashians had another baby. You've never had that happen ever in your life. It's not a thing. Here's the deal. To understand how they knew to follow a star to the land of Israel because they believed that a new king had been born, you have to understand who these people were, these wise men who had come from eastern lands. So if you have a Bible and it doesn't say wise men, it probably says magi. Magi is this word, it's an ancient Persian word, and it's talking about a specific person who belongs to like a priestly caste. A person who's like a sorcerer. Now, when you are like singing Christmas carols, you'll get to this one about the wise men. It's called We. Right, okay? So we probably get that song mostly wrong. I'm not saying not to sing it. I'm just saying don't get your theology or history from it because there's probably way more than three of them and they're not kings in the least. They're magi. Okay? Now, some of you guys are like, great, that doesn't help me at all. Here's the way I can explain magi to you. Think of a magi as being like an ancient analog form of Google. See, everybody at the time, 2,000 years ago, and I told you to put yourself in this mindset, 2,000 years ago, everyone is just trying to stay alive because there's wild animals, there's violent clashes, there's conflicts between tribes. Everyone is just trying to live for the day. But if you need answers to problems, you need people to search out those problems. So you would basically say, hey, this kid, he's really smart. That's the one that's gonna get educated. And in Persia, they had an entire class of people whose only job was to search out mysteries, to be basically an investigative reporter combined with a naturalist slash observational scientist. And it was their job to have answers to questions. So they understood maps and star charts. They understood the seasons. They were deeply invested in the natural world, in the paranormal. So you're looking at me right now like, so what you're basically saying is that like Gandalf and Dumbledore and Merlin showed up at Jesus' birthday. And I'm like, that's kind of the best way for you to understand it. Because they knew things that people didn't know. The things that magi did were called magic. People couldn't understand how they knew. But you would ask the magi, say you're the king and you want to go to war against another country. You'd say, is it going to be safe for us to attack this country? We're going to attack at night. Will there be a full moon? They would consult their records and they'd say, based on our understanding of the skies, it will not be a full moon that night. Go ahead and attack. If you were a civic leader and you were thinking to yourself, hey, is it gonna be a rough winter? They would say, well, we can tell by the angle of the sun and we can tell by the frost on the trees that it's gonna be a pretty rough harvest and it's gonna be a really cold winter. So store up as much food as you can now. Also, if you'd like to get wealthy during this time, get as much food as you can and then sell some of it to the other kingdoms around us who will be struggling. And then you'll become more powerful. So these were very good, they were like advisors to royalty. Geniuses. These guys had been studying, and in their studying, they had come across Hebrew scripture. Remember that the people of Israel had been carried into captivity in Babylon, which was then conquered by the Persian Empire. So they have access to the sacred writings of many cultures. And in their reading of the Hebrew scriptures, they discovered something in the book of Numbers, chapter 24, that really piqued their interest, but didn't make much sense at the time. Here's what they read in Numbers chapter 24, and you need to know this. This passage comes from a really arcane story of the Bible that most of us don't know a lot about. But when God was leading the people, using Moses, from Egypt into the promised land of Israel, as that group of people was traveling through the deserts, they found themselves under like deep attack from other countries. Everyone was terrified of this new nation being born. So a lot of the other kings got together and they hired a magi, a sorcerer named Balaam, and they said, "We want you to cast a curse upon the people of Israel. So go stand on the mountain and call down a curse upon them." And every time he tried to do it, three times, the Spirit of God came on him, and instead he offered a blessing and a prophecy. And in one of those blessings and prophecies that we have written down in the book of Numbers chapter 24, Balaam says this, right? He's saying, "I can see him, but not here and now. I perceive him, but far in the distant future. A star will rise from Jacob." Jacob, whose name is changed to Israel. So a star will rise from the people of Israel and a scepter will emerge. And a scepter is the king's staff. There is no king in Israel at the point that this prophecy is being made. They're following Moses. He says, "I can see distant times in the future that a king will come to the people of Israel." So when they, standing there looking at the stars, see a wandering star that isn't where it's supposed to be or where they're used to seeing it, they go, "This is the sign." That piece of information that we had that did not make sense, that a king has been born to the people of Israel. And that's when they get on their bikes and ride. So it says this, right? And that when they arrive and they tell Herod, that everybody freaks out. It says this in Matthew chapter 2, verse 3. "King Herod was deeply disturbed when he heard this, as was everyone in Jerusalem. He called a meeting of the leading priests and teachers of religious law," so people who were experts in the Hebrew scriptures, "and asked, 'Where is the Messiah supposed to be born?'" You see, the collection of Hebrew scriptures describes the fact that this person sent from God to be a king and shepherd over the people Israel is going to come. All the way back in the book of Genesis, right after Adam and Eve blow it in the garden, God promises that he's going to send someone. So I don't know if you know the story of the Bible, but like Adam and Eve, there's not a lot of story before that. So for all of the recorded time that the Jewish people have, they've been looking forward to this king coming. So these guys are experts in studying their own scriptures, and they have a piece of information that the Magi don't have. "In Bethlehem, in Judea," they said, "for this is what the prophet wrote. 'And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are not least among the ruling cities of Judah. For a ruler will come from you who will be the shepherd for my people Israel.'" So about a day's journey away from Jerusalem, that's where Bethlehem is. They say, "Oh, well, the scriptures say that he's not going to be born in Jerusalem. He's going to be born in Bethlehem. So you guys need to go to this different city." And this city, it's in the county of Judea. "Then Herod called for a private meeting with the wise men, and he learned from them the time when the star first appeared. He told them, 'Go to Bethlehem and search carefully for the child. And when you find him, come back and tell me so that I can go and worship him too.'" Now, I've already told you straight away that Herod is the bad guy. He has no intention of worshiping the baby Jesus the way that the Magi want to worship the baby Jesus. He's actually doing the math in his head. And there's a very important clue here, right? He says, "How long have you been traveling? When did the star first appear?" And then he starts doing the math. We know that Herod will have the children in Bethlehem killed, starting at age 2. So how long have they been traveling? They've probably been traveling almost 2 years at this point. The Herod is flattering them, isn't he? He's telling them what they want to hear so that they will do what he wants them to do. "Hey, I'm just like you guys, and you should give me the information that I want because I'm gonna do the same thing you're going to do." But instead, he's about to launch a terrible plan. It says that after this interview, the wise men went their way, and the star that they had seen in the east guided them to Bethlehem. And it went ahead of them, and it stopped over the place where the child was. And when they saw the star, they were filled with joy. So this wasn't some sort of chore. This was the end result of all of this work that they had been doing. This detail of, we saw this piece and we attached it to this piece and we put everything together and we've dedicated the last 2 years of our life to do something totally new and totally different. They are filled with joy to get to this spot in the story. It's like they are one integer away in the math problem. You've been in a situation like this where the very next moment is the moment of completion and you're so excited. Maybe it was the day before your wedding, the day before you got engaged. Maybe it was the day before your first child was born. Maybe it's just the night before Christmas, but that anticipation and having so much joy about what's going to take place. It says this. Then they entered the house and saw the child with his mother Mary. Jesus was born in a stable, and they put him in a manger. This says Jesus is in a, so this is later. This isn't the night that Jesus is born. This is a home visit. They entered the house and saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshiped him. Then they opened their treasure chests and gave him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. So these are the gifts that we hearken back to. When we give gifts at Christmas time, it's because this took place, that these people came and they brought treasure chests. Three guys on three camels with three chests, you're not making it all the way across the deserts of the ancient world. This is probably a procession. There are probably armed guards and soldiers. There are servants. They have to bring enough food to get from the east to Jerusalem. So this royal procession shows up and they open up the treasure chest and they give gold and frankincense and myrrh. And these three gifts tell us exactly who the Magi are inside, and it tells us who they see Jesus as. Because these are very specific gifts to give. The first is gold. They give Jesus gold, and gold is, it's a kingly tribute. Whenever a king comes to power, they issue taxation notices. This is what it's going to cost for me to administrate the kingdom, and you need to pay me to do it. So to pay your taxes is a sign that you're recognizing the authority of the government. Beyond this, when a king would conquer another country, they would oftentimes leave the other king in charge, but they would exact tribute or payment from them in gold. So it's the sign that I recognize your authority over us to pay that tribute. When they bring Jesus gold, they're saying, we don't just see you as a king. We don't see you as the king. We see you as our king. This Christmas, are you celebrating Christmas as the birth of a king? As the birth of the best king? Or are you celebrating the birth of your king, the person you are surrendering and submitting and living in loyalty towards? Because that's who Jesus is. You see, in the book of Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah declares this when talking about the Messiah. He says, his government and its peace will never end. So this isn't a king that's gonna come and go. He will rule with fairness and justice from the throne of his ancestor David for all eternity. Where was David from? Anybody remember? Bethlehem. David had started out as a shepherd. And that Jesus has come from the line of David to be the shepherd of God's people again, except his God's people now includes all of us, not just the people of Israel. The passionate commitment of the Lord of heaven's armies will make this happen. This is certain because God and all of his power is going to do this. And so today, if you are following Jesus, Jesus is the king of your heart. The kingdom has come in you and it's coming through you to the world. The question is, are you giving the best of all that you are, all that you have, your finest in tribute to your king? Because that's what it is to trust Jesus, to give your life to him in faith, is to say, I belong to you and I will rearrange everything I'm doing to accomplish your purposes. Now, frankincense, it's a type of incense. We know this because guess what it's called? Frankincense. I'd like to tell you something really smart about the frank part of that. I'm just gonna stay on the incense part of that. Here's what incense is used for all across the ancient world at this time. It's used in worship, in ceremonial worship. So a priest is someone who mediates. They're like a lawyer who goes between God and people. And it didn't matter what religion you were at this point in time, priests poured out incense on altars on behalf of people in their worship of God. It was well known that priests smelled like incense. It was essential to ancient forms of worship because this is the way primitive peoples thought. And it makes sense if you think about it. If God is up there and we're down here and we want to give him something, the way to give it to him is to burn it on an altar and then send the fragrance up to him. And what better than a beautiful fragrance to send to him? So what they're saying is, we don't just see you as our king, we also see you as our priest, the person who's going to mediate the relationship between God and humanity. Now, here's what's crazy. Some of you are sitting here and you're thinking, well, John, I know a lot about the Bible. I've even gotten a degree in it. And I know that Jesus can't be a priest because you just said Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea and he was an ancestor of David from the tribe of Judah, and all of the priests come from the house of Levi, the priests and the Levites. How can Jesus be a priest if he's from the house of Judah? Here's the good news. Remember, David is like one of those warrior poet, like Tupac kind of people. He's ruling the country and he's also pouring out all this amazing poetry, that in this situation, David has written a song. And in this song, in the book of Psalms, chapter 110, verse 4, there's a line, and this line says this: the Lord has taken an oath and will not break his vow. So he's talking to the Messiah here. You are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. And you're like, that sounds like a wizard, Melchizedek. Here's what you need to know, right? Long before the Hebrew priests, long before there was ever a tribe of Levi, the Bible tells us about one priest, the first priest, and his name is Melchizedek. And when Abram worships God in the city of Salem, he offers 10% of everything he has and worships God. And that sacrifice is mediated by a priest named Melchizedek, who's the priest before all other priests. And in the book of Hebrews in the New Testament, the author of Hebrews says that Jesus is greater than all priests, even Melchizedek, because he is God's final priest, the final intercessor or mediator between God and man. And so when they give him frankincense, they are saying, we see you in your role as the mediator between God and humanity. Now, frankincense is expensive, but frankincense is not as expensive as myrrh. Myrrh is an ointment. It's a fragrance that costs about 5 times the amount. So if it would be like you're buying myrrh at like the department store counter, you're buying frankincense at like Walgreens. 5 times the price. It's 5 times more expensive because it's rare and it's super hard to get. Here's what you need to know about myrrh. It comes from one specific tree that really only grows at the edge of the Arabian Peninsula, where Yemen or Oman or Qatar or any of these places are in the world today. And the tree is covered in all these thorns and the sap is really fragrant. So if you want to get it, you got to go to the tree and you got to cut the bark. And then as the tree weeps that sap and it starts to harden and crystallize, you've got to come back a couple of months later and scrape the bark to get the myrrh. The problem is the tree isn't just covered in thorns, it's also covered in poisonous snakes. So you got to build a fire around it to get the snakes out of the tree so you can get the myrrh, and that's why it's so expensive. And myrrh was prized throughout the ancient world for 2 reasons. The first one is this: it has a bit of a hallucinogenic property in it. So people would take it and they would put it in their wine and then they would drink it and get lit. Now, the Romans loved myrrh in their wine. I'm not saying you should do it, I'm just saying it got did back then, okay? That's what they would do. The second thing is, when someone died, they would stretch out linens. And because it took a long time for people to come travel and visit the family of the deceased, they would spread aloe and myrrh on the linen and they would roll the body in it. And it would embalm the body, keeping the smell of death away, preserving it until the ceremonies could be held, and then the person would be entombed. And we see this taking place, both uses, in Jesus' death. The Gospel of Mark tells us that when Jesus is hanging on the cross, they take a sponge and they mix it with vinegar and myrrh and they put it to Jesus' lips because they're trying to dull the pain of crucifixion for him, but he refuses it. And the second is that when Jesus is taken off the cross, Nicodemus and Joseph, two very wealthy men, take him and they prepare his body by wrapping it in aloe and myrrh. You see, what they're seeing is that Jesus is not just the King of Kings. He's not just the priest of priests. He's the sacrifice of all sacrifices. He is going to be the final sacrifice offered on Passover for all of the people of the world. And so in Isaiah chapter 53, verse 9, they would have undoubtedly come across this. He had done no wrong and had never deceived anyone, but he was buried like a criminal. He was put in a rich man's grave. You see, each of the gifts demonstrated the character of the giver, and it said, we see who you are to the receiver. They weren't just gifts that were expensive, undoubtedly they were. They weren't just gifts that were interesting, undoubtedly they were. They were gifts that declared, this is who I am and this is who you are, and our relationship is, we are your subjects. We depend on you for our worship, and you have taken our place in sacrifice. That's why they said, we have come to worship him. Here's the brilliant part. They had never even met him yet. They had begun a relationship with someone they had not yet met, a relationship of loyalty, of love, of submission. That's what it is that God is looking for from each of us, is for us to say, Jesus is my king and I will live this way. I will offer him my heart, because once he has my heart, everything else will follow. So let me ask you this. When you're a kid, Christmas is something that happens because somebody else makes it for you. But when you're a grown-up, when it's not about getting presents, it's about giving, that's when it becomes about Jesus. That's when it becomes about offering Christmas to others. That Christmas that has come to you now comes through you. What is Jesus asking you to offer and provide this Christmas season? You see, so often we want to just do things, but we don't want to be different people. When we trust Jesus and we give him our heart, he makes us a different person and different things come from us. So Christmas doesn't have to be about buying a really shiny sedan and putting a bow on it and putting it in the driveway for somebody to be happy. It doesn't have to be about a Nintendo Switch. It doesn't have to be about a really expensive, extravagant demonstration. You can do those things any other day of the year. You want to buy your kid a video game system? Buy it for them on the 24th or the 26th. It may even be cheaper on the 26th. But do something that says something about your character and their character and your relationship on December 25th. Do it in such a way that points out how amazing Jesus is on the 25th. Let Christmas be Christmas. What if you got your daughter something? And it doesn't have to be a thing. It can be an experience. It can be a letter. What if you got her something that says, you have my heart and my attention? What if you got something for your son that said, I see exactly who you are and I want to help you become all that God created you to be? What if you got your husband something that said, I understand you and I admire you? What if you got something to communicate to your wife? I cherish you and you are more important than any of my other pursuits. What if you got something for your friend that said, it's been really hard, but we are going to get through this together? That's when Christmas that has come in you comes through you. When we give gifts the way the Magi gave gifts to Jesus. It starts with giving our hearts to Jesus, and then it comes with giving our beliefs and thoughts and feelings to others. And that changes everything, doesn't it? Here's the thing. The Magi were studious. Their diligence in all of the details is what produced that great moment at the end. It was something they did year round, probably for 2 years. All of that investigation to take the time to get to know who Jesus was and what he was going to do gave them the clues that they needed to offer him the gifts that demonstrated all those things that gifts should demonstrate. If you're here today, you want to have a great Christmas day, go downstairs and pick up one of the Advent devotions to do with your family. Every day for this month, it's a devotion that you can do. And doing the details every day will produce something greater on the day. We don't have to just celebrate Jesus at Christmas time. You can celebrate him every day. Every day of the year. See, I want God to speak to me. And the truth is I want him to speak in a big cloud-like voice. And the truth is he's speaking to me in his word every day. And I won't recognize his big cloud-like voice if I'm not recognizing the still small voice. Take the time to do the details. They were sacrificial. They dug down deep to declare their devotion. There probably wasn't a moment when they said, well, you know, we could probably not get him myrrh. There's probably a designer imposter somewhere. He'll never know the difference. No, what it is, they basically gave up 2 years of their life. They were willing to disappoint other people in their pursuit of what Jesus wanted. Isn't that interesting? That they basically had to take ownership of their own lives to do what God was asking them to do. And I guarantee there were people who were like, well, I was really hoping the soldiers and the wise men would stay home this year. We had questions we needed answered. If they'd stayed local, they could have spent their money local and stimulated the economy. Everybody has expectations of you. Do God's expectations of you. Let him direct and reset what it is he wants in your life. You know, they never talked back to Herod. God came to them in a dream, and his big voice told them in a dream, don't talk to Herod again and don't go home the way you came, because he doesn't want anything good with his family. And they were safeguarding. You see, they fought Herod's flattery to defend Jesus' family. And that is one of your jobs this Christmas season. Everyone is gonna try to flatter you into getting what they want from you. But you need to do what God wants you to do. And so if you do the details and you're willing to make the sacrifices, you will hear the voice of God speak loud and clear to your heart and tell you what to do and affirm you when you do it. Isn't that beautiful? They had trained themselves to hear the voice of God, and that benefited Joseph, Mary, and Jesus, who went to Egypt until that Herod was dead. What is it God is asking of you this Christmas season? How does he want to shape and transform and change you this Christmas season? Because that will change the way you act at Christmas season, and that will demonstrate a love that is grace-filled and giving this Christmas season. Let's pray. Father, you're so good to us. We love you and we care what you say to us. We want to be obedient to you. I pray that you would press us into those details. Teach us to sacrifice. And we would live in such a way that safeguards what you want instead of pursuing what we want. In Jesus' name, amen.